All right. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Jays Talk Plus on Sportsnet 360 and the Sportsnet Radio Network. Show Ali, Julia Kreutz here with you for the next couple of hours. On the program today, Shai Davidi will join us live from Texas. That'll be in a few minutes. Catch up with him on the Home Run Derby and what's going to go on later tonight. The All-Star Game happening this evening, 7:30. You can watch it on Sportsnet. Coverage on Sportsnet 590. The Fan begins at 7 o'clock Eastern. The game itself starts at 8. Eric Longenhagen will join us from Fangraphs at the top of the next hour to discuss the draft so far for the Blue Jays, including a variety of the day two picks. And Micah Norrie, father of Toronto-born Phillies first-round draft pick Dante Norrie, will join us at the bottom of the hour. But before we get to all that, Jules, Shai again in a couple of minutes. Before we get to Shai, the Derby was a ton of fun. I got to say, I really enjoyed it. Tons of drama. The new rules, I thought, played out very well. Teoscar Hernandez absolutely murdering a bunch of baseballs on live television. I think we did all right when it came to our predictions. You picked Bobby Witt. I got Teo, and things went okay.
Yeah, I will reveal here, show that when we found out who the finalists would be, I did text you saying, you know what? Even a broken clock is right twice a day, right? It's not always that we get something right in this program, show. So when we do, we really need to celebrate. However,
we don't have to rub Ben Shulman's face in picking Pete Alonso. We don't have to remind everyone that he was incorrect about picking Pete Alonso. I'm just saying.
I mean, it was a good pick. It was a good pick.
Apparently, it wasn't a good
time.
Pick.
However, that does not mean that we're not going to make fun.
This is true.
So, all things considered, it was so much fun. It was. I agree with you that the new format works. We get to see guys beyond, you know, a time limit or a pitch limit. This bonus round, as they call it, has added some new dynamics to the tournament, and overall, it was really fun. And I think that, you know, I know that's something that Blue Jays fans miss quite a bit, is seeing the interactions and the fun and the levity between Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Teoscar Hernandez. And so that to me was one of the highlights, is seeing them, you know, have those moments of friendship again and be able to share a moment. Vladdy, obviously the champion last year, handing over the trophy.
And the chain?
I know.
That was pretty cool.
All of it was, it was pretty special. And I think it was kind of a storyline ending to it too.
We'll talk about this a little bit later on. We're going to do some more Derby stuff and certainly All-Star Game memories and what to look forward to maybe a little bit at the bottom of the next hour, well, some time after we chat with Eric Longenhagen. But I do want to say, I think, like, if Teoscar Hernandez was the star of the night, the first star, let's call him, and if Bobby Witt Jr. was the second star, then honestly, I think the third star of the Home Run Derby was Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Like,
wow.
I actually think beyond those two guys who I think did really put on a show in the final matchup there, with Michael Buffer announcing, let's get ready to rumble. It was pretty cool. They had some pomp and circumstance to it. But beyond the two of those guys, I actually think Vladdy's presence and him going out to tell Teo, hey, like, hit to left center, hit to the bullpen, do all these things, I almost feel like that overshadowed, in not a bad way, but just it got more play than maybe like 6 out of 8 participants in the Derby. Like, no one remembers Pete Alonso's Derby now. No one remembers even like Jose Ramirez, who had a pretty good first round, but no one really thinks of that anymore. What you think of is Vladdy going out there wearing the Teo Blue Jays jersey and kind of being the oracle of the Home Run Derby, essentially.
I'll tell you what else I'll remember is Alec Bohm's personality.
Yeah.
He was mic'd up for that, and he was really funny. we spoke a little bit about this yesterday. This is an opportunity for fans to see a different side of these players, for players themselves to just let loose a little bit and show what they're capable of, as well as who they are. And, you know, I think mission accomplished here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'll say this. I did not know Alec Bohm had a personality. I'll be completely honest. But, I mean, how many Phillies games am I, like, really going out of my way to watch? And just think about it like this. When you think of the Phillies, who's the one person on that team you know for a fact has a giant personality? It's Bryce Harper, right? And Bryce Harper, I think, it's also followed him around for ages because, I mean, it's kind of fun. It certainly was new with the Nationals as well. But going back to when he was drafted, like, remember he was viewed as like the next chosen one. Like, there was that cover on Sports Illustrated where it was like LeBron James was the chosen one, and then it was the next chosen one was Bryce Harper. And like, I think, like, by and large, I know he hasn't won a World Series yet, but by and large, he has lived up to that hype. But like, he's the guy you think of on that team who has like a larger than life personality. But Alec Bohm and a lot of these guys, not just Bohm, but pretty much all of them have gigantic personalities, and not in a bad way, but they're just, that's how they are. And it was kind of fun to see. I agree.
And they get along too. I think that was something else that we took away from that, was just the bond of those players, with Trey Turner obviously involved as well during the Derby. So again, a lot of opportunity for just discovering new sides of this game and of these players.
Teoscar Hernandez, I do wonder as well. I mean, people probably watch a lot of Dodgers games, I would guess. But
I would assume so, with a guy named Shohei Ohtani over there.
Yeah, right, and if Shohei was there, he was present with all of these guys. I did think it was funny that all of the people who could have been in, like, Teoscar Hernandez's corner, first of all, I think a lot of people are discovering that, 10 trillion megawatt smile that he has, because he put it on full display last night. But it was pretty funny because Shohei wasn't really a part of the festivities in terms of being in Teo's corner throughout the night. It was Vladdy and, oddly, Tyler Glasnow. I did not expect that. I got to say, like, if I had to pick like one Dodger who would have been handing him like water bottles and stuff all night, I don't think I would have picked, like, of all people, I don't think I would have picked Tyler Glasnow.
Again, that's pretty cool though, right? It kind of reminds you that a clubhouse is made of 26 players, and that was on full display there.
Shai Davidi joining us here live from Texas, MLB columnist, MLB insider for Sportsnet, sportsnet.ca. Shai, how's it going today?
All right, how are you guys?
We're doing all right. Look, before we get to the home run derby, you heard us talking about it. As I understand, you are an avid celebrity softball fan. So, like, were you covering this for sportsnet.ca?
Fan is, I think you got that reversed. it is... look, I get like the attraction for some people, how they might enjoy it, but like, especially this one, like, I mean, they're all a lot about this, but it was just noise. Like, I didn't even like, there's just like, the speakers are super loud and there's this nonsense happening on the field and everyone's like trying to ham it up and be funny. It just feels like a very contrived event. And, sometimes there are like some funny moments, like a player who has the history and ties to the team and puts on a bit of a show. I didn't even notice that this year. There may have been, but there was just overwhelming, blaring, just nonstop noise. And it was just like, this is not good.
Well, you know what? The Derby, I think, is viewed as somewhat of a salve for these events. So I can only imagine that was a little bit more fun than the celebrity softball game. I do admit the one clip I did see from the celebrity softball game was, I think it was Kid Mero intentionally leaning into a pitch from Pedro Martinez, and then he charged the mound. I think that was pretty much my only exposure to it, which I did think was kind of entertaining. But on a more fun note, the Derby last night, I heard your question to Teoscar Hernandez about Vladdy wearing his jersey. I got to say, that was a fun moment. Like, the Derby, Shai, I think, exists maybe by itself amongst, like, if you take out the actual All-Star game amongst all other sports, and you're comparing it to, like, you know, the slam dunk contest or the three-point contest, both in the NBA, or like the fastest skater competition in the NHL. Like, I think if you're comparing it to all of these ancillary events, I think it stands alone, and I think those kinds of moments are what fans really want, because they are for fans. It was a pretty fun moment in a night full of them, I thought.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the one thing the Derby does really well is that they have players hanging out on the side, right, with the couches and foul territory, so you can kind of create those interactions, and it becomes sort of like this tag team kind of group event, and that creates a really neat dynamic with the participants. But the other thing is, you know, watching dudes hit homers is cool, right? Like, we don't need to make it more complicated than that. And I like the head-to-head format. And I think the little tweak this year with adjusting the first round and just taking the top four of that maybe made it a bit more fair. But, you know, it's not just about one round. There's an endurance element to that, which is the guys really have to grind through it. And so, yeah, I do think it's really entertaining in a way some of those other events are, and that, you know, with the slam dunk contest, for instance, you know, there's only so many dunks that you can do, right? At a certain point, you're sort of traipsing into sideshow there a little bit with some of the things that guys are trying to pull off just because they're trying to do something creative and new. And with the Derby, doesn't have to be that. Just hit a lot of homers, and it's going to be a good time, and that's what they've done.
Shai, I wanted to ask you about, in the sense of, or in light of your comments about home runs being really cool, Pete Alonso notably once said, home runs are sick. but wondering if you were a bit surprised by his performance. You know, a guy that was attempting to become the second ever to win three times, didn't really get a whole lot done. Was it the new format? Was it something else? And were you surprised by that?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't get a chance to talk to him post-derby or anything like that, so I'm not sure. But, you know, sometimes you just don't find that groove and that rhythm. And it's surprising because he's been so good at it for so long that every year he's a real contender that he's in it. And this one just wasn't flying. And, you know, we didn't see some of the massive numbers this year that you've seen in some previous years with, like, these absolute monster rounds. I think the biggest round was Bobby Witt and Jose Ramirez at 21 homers. And so I'm not sure. It is a bit of a bigger ballpark. I mean, the ball does fly there. And, you know, they probably wind those balls a little bit tighter so they go a little bit more. But, yeah, it was very strange. I think it was surprising for a lot of people. And I don't know, but disappointing is the right word, but a lot of people were probably hoping to see Alonso be a bit more of a factor. So, yeah, it was pretty surprising. But again, you know, sometimes it's just finding the rhythm. And, you know, I was talking about this with someone last night. There's lots of good home run hitters who've gone there and had really bad performances, right? Like, you think about Josh Donaldson having a really quiet one. Jose Bautista one year didn't perform especially well. Then ended up coming back and getting to the finals. So sometimes it just doesn't go your way.
You mentioned, Shai, that we didn't see the monster rounds this time around, right? And again, I think it'll take a couple of tries for us to figure out if this is the new format or if this is just one instance. But if this turns out to be a trend, do you believe that fans will miss those 40-something home run rounds?
I mean, in theory, I guess it's still possible, right? Someone just has to be out of their mind a little bit. But I think I like this better than the, you know, the old 10 out formula, because I think that really led to a lot of pressure in some of those quiet rounds that guys would sometimes have. And then the other way, it might have been too much to just say, like, okay, go nuts for this time period. You know, adding the pitch limit with the time clock gives players a bit of an opportunity to manage their rounds and to maybe take a break. So, you know, they're not doing anything where they avoid injury. And I think you saw Teoscar Hernandez do that really well yesterday, where he just took some pitches, right? Just said, I need a breather, just keep throwing them, and then I'm just going to rest, and then we'll get after it again. And so it's tough to find that one sweet spot where you satisfy all the different needs. Yeah, like, you know, I think that the best round I ever saw was Josh Hamilton at Old Yankee Stadium, and I guess that was 08, right? Like, that was just one of the most insane displays of hitting and raw power that you might ever see. I don't know if we'll have that again, but I do think the head-to-head piece brings a lot more drama to it, and I think it works.
We're chatting with Shai Davidi, MLB columnist and insider for Sportsnet.ca here on Jays Talk Plus. Show and Julia here with you until 12 Eastern. So, Shai, you mentioned Josh Hamilton in 08. I think it was in 08 as well where that was the game, the year the All-Star game itself went into extras. I seem to recall Miguel Tejada scoring on a sac fly. I think that was the year Deonor Navarro, when he played for the Rays, got thrown out in extras at home plate. Like, when you think of your favorite All-Star memories, what comes to mind? Like, tonight it goes at 7:30 on Sportsnet. 8 Eastern is around when first pitch goes. But for you personally, you've attended a lot of these games. Any real favorites come to mind?
Man, you're putting me on the spot there. To be honest, and this is going to sound bad, they all sort of blend into one another a little bit. Like, at least when I'm covering it, you're sort of running around, and like, the game is sort of the last thing you end up doing, and it goes by in an instant. I'm just struggling to pick a spot. I do think watching Vlad in 21 in Denver, when he hit that home run and then was MVP of the game, I thought that was kind of a neat moment. That game will be special to me in a few ways, because it was the first live game I covered coming out of the pandemic shutdown.
That's right. Yeah.
And so it was like my first time in a year and a half watching a live baseball game. And so I definitely appreciated it in that way. So maybe for some oddball reasons, maybe that 21 game is going to hold a little bit of a special memory for me.
Yeah, and Shai is, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Shai is now kind of like the, it almost feels like he's like the old man at these games, right? He's like already the MVP at one point in his career. He's won the Derby. He was like the home run Derby oracle last night, essentially, for a whole variety of guys, including Teoscar Hernandez. It's pretty fun to watch, but I do appreciate you searching the memory banks for me. I saw online you had your piece written on sportsnet.ca talking about the season of Vladimir Guerrero Jr., the season the Blue Jays have had, 44-52 here at the All-Star break. And I'd seen in the article, I guess you had asked him about staying in Toronto and how, you know, he understands that it's a business, right? It's we all need to understand that whatever happens, happens. But, you know, it seemed he reiterated his desire to stay in Toronto long term. And I think a lot of fans do want that as well. Like how I don't know if likely is the right way to ask this question, but how easy do you think would it be for if the Jays wanted Vladdy to sign on the dotted line? If they wanted that to happen before the deadline or by the end of the season, is that an easy proposition, or do you think there's still some roadblocks there?
I don't know that it's an easy proposition, right? Because it's obviously a big decision. He's like a year and a couple months away from free agency at that point. And so you can say there's a good case for him to want to wait it out a little bit and see where it goes, at least for through this offseason, see what happens with Juan Soto, who's got a chance to reset the market a little bit. And what does that do for pricing? I can see him wanting to at least let that play out. But I think ultimately, if two sides want to stay together, they find ways to stay together. And that means that the player bends a little bit, the team bends a little bit, and both teams come out of the negotiation feeling like they got a fair deal. And if those pieces can align, then I don't think it has to be complicated, overly complicated. But again, both sides have to jump into it feeling like, okay, we want to get this done and we have enough common ground to get that done. And right now, I don't know that there's enough common ground there for them to arrive at that sweet spot where, both ends of it feel comfortable with the number, feel like it's a fair number. And that can certainly change. But a number of factors are going to change too. And the closer a player gets to free agency, typically the higher the price is because there's more certainty for the club. And you have to buy the player out of the opportunity to talk to the other 29 teams.
Yeah.
So that's basically where the sides are at. And I don't expect it to be something that comes up between now and the deadline. If sides are going to hammer something out, you'd have to start well in advance of that. So this is something that, the teams will have to, or the sides will have to punt to the off season, and we'll see where it goes from there.
Shai, with that in mind, and in light of how the first half went for the Blue Jays, I know that this ends up being an unfair question because there's so much uncertainty, so many question marks, but if you had to project, or what do you expect the Blue Jays to do, the approach to be at this trade deadline, which figures to be at least different from ones we've seen in different years for this team?
Yeah, I mean, this is a subtraction deadline, and that's pretty clear. And I think the debate with a debate such that it is within the industry right now is like, how deep do they go? And my expectation, based on everything I've heard to this point, is that it's going to be focused on an expiring contract. So your guys are going to be free agents at the end of this season. So Yusei Kikuchi and Jimmy Garcia and Danny Jansen and Trevor Richards and Justin Turner. But I do know there are some teams in the industry who are wondering if the Blue Jays might do something a little bit deeper than that. And they have a very significant class of players who are pending free agents at the end of 25. And that includes Guerrero and Bichette and those hurt right now, Jordan Romano, Chad Green, a lot of pieces that other teams would certainly be interested in and enticed by. Chris Bassett's in that mix too. So there, some teams are wondering, well, will the Jays go a little bit deeper? But I think right now the plan is for them to just shed their expiring contracts and then reset and try to compete again with this group in 25. But, this is a trade deadline. Strange things happen. If another club comes with an offer that the Blue Jays can't refuse, then I can certainly see them shifting gears or at least considering a one-off deal like along those lines.
We are about exactly 2 weeks away from the Major League Baseball trade deadline. So whatever happens, happens, Shai, and you'll be covering it for Sportsnet.ca. Thanks for catching up with us. We appreciate it, man. Enjoy the All-Star game. I know you got to run around a lot, so we'll let you go, but I'm sure I'll see you soon.
Yeah, all right. Take care, guys. Appreciate it.
There he goes. That's Shai Davidi, MLB columnist, insider for Sportsnet.ca. Yeah, I thought it was interesting the comments he had written in the article on Sportsnet.ca about Vladdy, because I think Vladdy is always going to be a story here in Toronto. Like, whether he likes it or not, whether fans like it or not, that's just always going to be the case. At the very least, until he signs some kind of, until he's no longer a Blue Jay or until he signs some kind of ginormous contract extension. And the contract talks, Jules, for me, always, I find them so interesting because ultimately, A, we have no idea what's going to happen, but B, like, the valuation from Vladdy's camp and the valuation from the Blue Jays camp still seem to be, like, relatively speaking, not all that close. But you look at how first basemen have historically been paid across Major League Baseball, and, like, the Bryce Harper deal, I think, is probably approximately what he's looking at. Having said that, Bryce Harper, I'm, like, reasonably certain signed that deal before he was a first baseman. I think he was, like, a right fielder or an outfielder when he signed that deal with the Phillies. Matt Olson's getting paid pretty highly. Freddie Freeman and Paul Goldschmidt and Pete Alonso are all getting paid a lot, but they're also a little bit older. Like, Vladdy's relatively youth when he hits free agency compared to when all these other guys signed their deals, I think makes it kind of a tough thing to value ultimately.
It does make it hard to value, show, because honestly, you look at guys like Alonso or Harper and or even Matt Olson, and there's maybe a little bit more of a track record of consistency, and Vladdy is still kind of searching for that after the big season that he had. So it's going to be complicated, and that's a reason why the numbers are so different between the two parties here. It's because one side believes that who he is the MVP runner-up, and one side believes perhaps that there is not, or that he hasn't done enough at least to warrant that type of deal. And, and I believe that Vladdy is going to encounter that here. He's going to encounter that with the offers from other teams as well. But you are right that his youth plays in his favor. And he has shown, especially in recent weeks here, or to close out the first half, that he still has it, right? He still has the power. He still has the ability to change a game with one swing. You're never going to be too worried about batting average with him. He's a guy that can put the bat on the ball, and he is going to hit it with thunder. But you know, it really depends on whether he's putting the ball on the ground or if he's lifting it in the air. And that is going to be... It's so simple when you put it in those terms, but that's going to be the difference maker for his contract when he does sign.
Yeah, he corrected his swing, and in Shai's piece, which I do recommend people read on sportsnet.ca, he had a little bit of a chat with Teoscar Hernandez, funnily enough, of all people, so maybe paying him back a bit of a favor during the home run derby, but he made his correction in terms of swing mechanics and how, I remember talking to Barker about this, where he is standing in relation to the plate and how he's swinging the bat. And in May, only 7 extra base hits, but he did bat .357. In the month of June, he slugged .608 in the month that included 8 home runs and 7 doubles. So, and I mean, July is only midway over. It's kind of a tough month to gauge anyways because of the All-Star break. Less games, obviously, but he has still been swinging the bat pretty well.
Did you say eight home runs?
8 home runs in the month of June. Yeah, so, I mean, it's pretty good, right?
That is pretty good. I did not realize that he had hit that. We knew that the home runs were coming in bunches, but to finish with 8, I'm impressed. I didn't know that.
So he's getting paid $19.9 million right now via arbitration, obviously. And it's funny because he's already kind of getting paid a lot of money. You know what I mean? I just feel like the difference between what he's getting paid now and what he would get paid per on a yearly basis in terms of AAV, let's call it, is not going to be, in my opinion, won't be that different. Like, if the difference is, let's just round up to 20, right? Let's call it $20 million. And let's say what he's asking for is, and I don't know if this is the case, I'm just saying for the sake of this conversation, if what he's asking for is like $25 million, I don't know. Is it worth quibbling over losing someone like Vladdy over like $5 million a year in a sport like baseball? Mm-hmm. I personally say no. I think you give him that amount of money if that's what he's asking for.
And I think that we can go back to what Shai said.
Right.
If both parties want to make a deal work, they will make a deal work. And both sides will probably have to bend a little bit, meet in the middle and all of that. But we've seen even, you know, more extreme cases of that. Jose Ramirez is one of them who could have probably made more money had he left Cleveland. But this is a guy that truly wanted to stay there and believed in what that team was doing. And so he did. And we have seen and we have heard Vladimir Guerrero Jr. speak at length about how much he likes Toronto, how much he loves playing here, how much his family likes the city, and how settled he feels. Maybe that will play in the Blue Jays' favor. I agree with Shai. We're not going to see that probably before the deadline or even before the season is done. The Blue Jays are not really a team to negotiate these types of contracts mid-season.
Right.
But the clock is ticking, show. And this is, again, going to be one of the biggest storylines of the upcoming offseason.
It's going to be really interesting, that's for sure. And hey, at the very least, you will get to see, even though there's no baseball games being played for the Blue Jays until Friday, you will get to see Vladimir Guerrero Jr. on the diamond tonight, batting seventh for the American League in the All-Star game. Again, coverage begins on the radio at 7 Eastern across the Sportsnet radio network. You can watch it. Coverage begins on television at 7:30, and the game itself begins just after 8 Eastern. You're listening to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Sho Ali. That is Julia Kreutz. We're going to step aside. When we come back, we will chat with Micah Norrie, assistant coach of the Minnesota Timberwolves, but father of Dante Norrie, who was taken 27th overall by the Phillies on Sunday. Of course, Dante born here in Toronto. We'll chat all things Dante Norrie and maybe take a look into Micah's career as well on the other side. You're listening to Jays Talk Plus on the Sportsnet Radio Network and on Sportsnet 360.
Diving deep into the biggest stories in Toronto sports and the NFL, the J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus on the Sportsnet Radio Network. We're live on Sportsnet 360 as well. Thank you for being with us. Sho Ali, Julia Kreutz here with you until the top of the following hour at 12 p.m. Eastern hour, after which point we will make way for Going Deep with Donovan Bennett. Be sure to stay tuned for that. Reach the show anytime on the People's Text Line, 59590, name and location. Standard messaging and data rates may apply, but you can certainly feel free to weigh in on the Derby. You can weigh in on the tonight's All-Star Game, which will, of course, be on Sportsnet. Coverage begins 7:30 p.m. Eastern. Joining us right now on the show, Micah Norrie, assistant coach with the Minnesota Timberwolves, father of Dante Norrie, who's taken 27th overall by the Phillies on Sunday. And Micah, thank you for carving out some time for us. We really appreciate it. I just have to say congratulations. Congratulations to you, the whole family, Dante certainly as well. I mean, he deservingly gets rewarded for what I am sure is just an absolute ton of hard work. How are you and the family feeling after Sunday?
Very excited. I think that there is a little bit of relief for these guys, that all the draft picks, and not only at the college level, but the high school level. Yeah. I guess at the start of about this time last year is kind of when they're all the emphasis was put on them as far as the draft goes. So between the showcases and having a lot of eyes on them throughout all the different perfect game national stuff, the area codes, the East Coast Pro, and just feeling that you're under a microscope for about a year by these major league scouts. And then to hear your name called was obviously very, very exciting. But I also think a little bit of a relief from the fact that all the hard work to your point paid off. And now you get to continue on with your journey and hopefully one day play in a major league baseball stadium.
Absolutely. Well, congratulations again. There's a great picture circling online of Dante with, of all people, Kyle Schwarber, like well before either of them were in the Phillies organization. So I can only imagine they are both excited. How did that come about?
So Kyle Schwarber's from where I grew up in Middletown, Ohio. His father was actually the police chief there. So he went to the same high school that I did in Middletown. And then my dad had some connection to the coaching staff at Indiana University. And Kyle was a really good football player. He also was obviously a very good baseball player, and not sure which path he was going to go. Is he going to go to Ohio State and play football? But he enjoyed baseball. And my dad mentioned to Tracy Smith, who was the head coach at Indiana, about Kyle. And they came to watch Kyle play. And I think Kyle hit two or three home runs in a high school game. And they offered him. And then my dad lo and behold, 2 years later was a volunteer assistant over there with Tracy. So he got to actually coach Kyle. And we've just kind of been family friends. And then Dante, when I would take him, when our season was over, we'd go down and visit them in Bloomington at Indiana University. And he was on the field. And that's where you see those pictures of him right. with Kyle. And then they've kind of been fortunate enough. And Kyle's been very, very good to Dante as well as to the rest of our family, where now that Dante being bigger and can actually do some things as far as would work out with him in the winters at Kyle's place down in Middletown, he would come home there for the off season. So Kyle's been great to Dante. It's just crazy how things work out, and very, very fortunate to have an ally, if you will, in that organization with him.
Micah, thank you for doing this. Congratulations to you and the family. You mentioned how much hard work goes into this, and it's not just the draft, right? It's not just playing in high school. There's several moving parts and a lot of hard work before getting to this moment. But, you know, your own background in basketball and baseball, obviously this is a baseball family for all of you. The connection to a guy like Kyle Schwarber, how does that exposure from such a young age contribute to Dante's ability to handle maybe the pressures or the demands of being, you know, or vying for a professional career here?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that he's got a little bit of a cheat code, obviously, with myself having grown up in a NBA locker room, being NBA practices and all these type of things. And where it really helps him is it makes him realize and understand, number one, you see the hard work that these guys continue to put in when they get to that level of being on the actual big team, if you will. But the other thing, too, is what he realized, they're just normal people. And what I mean by that, that's such a big thing that, you know, and it sounds corny, but you see the old Hoosiers. Well, hey, it's still 10-foot rim. The free throw line's still 15-foot. So it's still 60-foot, 6 inches from the plate to the, you know, to the rubber. So no matter where you are, it's still you and the pitcher. But the big thing is growing up all these years, he's been around Vince Carter's. He's been around the Tracy McGrady's. He's been around, not Tracy as much, but, you know, he does know Vince, Kyle Lowry's, DeMar's, and those guys, and like the Chris Bosh. And I'll tell you real quick where you knew that he could kind of get it was Chris Bosh had been traded to Miami, or, you know, left as a free agent. And the next year, Dante, I think, was 6 or 7 years old, and the Miami Heat were waiting to go out in that tunnel right by our locker room in Toronto. And Chris Bosh had called him over. My wife, Melissa, was taking him back behind to the family room. And Chris goes, Dante, come here. And he went to give, you know, he gave Chris a hug. And then LeBron James and Dwayne Wade were next in line, getting ready to go take the floor. And they both reached out to dap up Dante. And Dante told him, I know who you are, but I'm a Raptors fan, and wouldn't give him Dukes. And so they respected it. But that just kind of shows you that, exactly to your point, that he's not going to be in all of these moments. And it's a great point that you bring up, that having this focus on you, he's used to it. It sounds crazy, but he has. Just from a very young age, he understands that it's just the same thing. It's the same game. It's this and that. Yeah, there's more people. There's more focus on you. But at the end of the day, it's still a game, whether it's baseball or basketball.
Yeah, I've heard him in the lead up to the draft discuss how he's been impressed with, let's say, Anthony Edwards in the weight room, for example, and how those things impress upon him the kinds of experiences you want to have when you look forward to guys who have made it and are trying to continue their careers, which is pretty cool. You mentioned your dad a couple of times, Fred Norrie, and you yourself are a former athlete in baseball and basketball before your career, certainly as a coach, and your dad, a former player in the Mets and Cubs systems. Suffice to say, he knows his stuff about baseball. What's the Fred Norrie scouting report on Dante Norrie versus maybe what it might have been on Micah Norrie?
It's very simple, and my dad reminds me all the time. Essentially, the speed is probably the one thing that stands out. And my dad reminds myself and my brother, who played Division I baseball as well, that the speed skipped a generation. So it went right from him. It skipped my brother and I and went to Dante. So my brother Brady, we get the brunt of that. But I think Dante, the big things that when you talk about, and when he's had all these meetings and you talk to these major league scouts leading up to this, is the things that they like is his speed, obviously. And the game is changing now, as we all know, with bigger bases, the pitch clock, and it's kind of bringing back small ball, if you will. It's not just home run, strikeout, or walk. So the small ball is coming into play, which fits to Dante. He's more of a gap-to-gap hitter. But the two big things, obviously the speed, but the other one is that the fact that he can stay in center field. He has strong enough arm and he can run. So that's a premier position right through the middle in baseball, as we all know. So the fact that he can stay in center field at the big league level if he stays healthy to get there. And then the other fact is that his control of the strike zone, he is a typical leadoff hitter, walks a lot more than he strikes out. Very good idea of the strike zone. When he swings, he makes contacts, not a swing and miss guy. So low strikeouts, high on base percentage, and gap to gap with some pop that he needs to develop a little bit more in game. And I think that's one of the points of emphasis that they'll make as he moves forward. But that's kind of a snapshot of him as a player.
He kind of reminds me, like, this is obviously the hitting the ceiling, I would say, because the guy I'm going to compare him to is the reigning NL Rookie of the Year. But he reminds me of Corbin Carroll to a certain extent. Like, you, a lot of the things you've described, I think, would also describe someone like Carroll. But, I mean, I saw some of the, you mentioned perfect game. I've seen some of the perfect game showcase highlights, and he has quite an arm, like, for a guy who is out there in the outfield. So I think I kind of wonder if you feel that's a fair comparison for me to make.
Very much so. It's funny when scouts came to the house in the morning in the meetings in the towards the end of the summer and the fall, that's one of the names that they definitely used was the Corbin Carroll. I think in that mold of guys that can run about Dante's size, like that 5'9", and obviously him being left and in the way that they run in the first to third. But no, it's a very good comparison. I think the other names that some people use would be like Brett Gardner back in the day, some Yankees type thing. But any, I would say, 5'10 to 5'11 center fielder, the area outfielder that can run a little bit with some pretty good bat to ball skills. But no, you're right in the wheelhouse of what these the comps that he was hearing all throughout the process.
Micah, with Dante being, you know, exposed to basketball as well, we hear more and more these days in baseball about versatility and the importance of versatility, as well as bringing perhaps elements from other sports into your game as a way to be a more well-rounded player. What is the advantage of that in your mind and in your experience? And is there something along those lines that Dante does specifically well?
Yeah, another very good question. I think the one thing that's tough to manage nowadays to me is specialization has become such a focus of people trying to get their kids to do one thing because they do want them to be the best at what they can. And growing up in the Midwest, it kind of helps from a standpoint that even from the weather, and even when we were in Toronto, it's not like you can go out and hit a baseball in the middle of winter for 12 months as kids do in California and Florida. But now you have all these indoor facilities where if you want to do that, you can. However, what I think that takes away from a little bit is exactly what you're talking about, the well-rounded athlete. Dante played soccer, and he never played football. He played flag football, but he did play soccer in the fall. And then in the winter, he did play basketball up until his freshman year of high school, and then baseball. And then so the specialization, I think, you can lead to some burnout. It also doesn't develop all the same, I guess, physical attributes and just mobility things that you need as far as, you know, there's a lot of different things you're doing in basketball and soccer than just on a baseball field. So I think that those movements obviously help. But the one thing Dante did do, and I think that we try, even when he was playing basketball and he was playing soccer, we would still make sure that we went down and we hit on a tee or we'd go to an indoor facility and front toss and get some BP there just to make sure that he continued his baseball skills. But playing other sports really, I think, two things, anytime time management, discipline, being part of a team and all those different things, especially in a sport where you may not be the best. I mean, obviously, you're pretty good because of an athletic standpoint. But, you know, baseball, most of the teams he was on, he was always the best player and things were a little bit easier, if you will. And it's good to see those struggles from different sports and have to try and adapt and play and find your way. So I think playing other sports, whether, even if it's gymnastics, tumbling, all that flexibility with it, even if it's in drama and just being used to other people and having to be out in front of a stage, to your point earlier about being able to focus throughout, no distractions. So anything you can do extracurricular wise, I think is a benefit. And Dante did all those things. His mom, Melissa, was great. And our daughter, Mia, does the same thing. And most of that is at her behest because I'm not going to lie. Every time we were playing pickup basketball when he was little, Nerf ball, I would block every single shot he took. I said, you're going to be a 5'9". You're not going to be that big. You'll pick up your bat. So yeah, I didn't let him have too much success. I didn't want him to enjoy basketball too much.
That's great. That's awesome. I'm curious, actually, mentioning the world of basketball, assistant coach as you are, I mean, what do you think of the differences between the two sports, basketball and baseball? Look, I love both dearly myself. I mean, the Raptors will always be a part of my sports fandom as a Toronto man born and raised. But and you look at basketball, right? Like, it moves at a bazillion miles an hour. Players are constantly switching between offense and defense. Every couple of seconds, there's always something happening. Whereas in baseball, it's almost like a sport of failure. Like, the first event in baseball that happens every single game is the pitcher trying to prevent the batter from doing anything. It's like a negative act, essentially. And if a guy is connecting with the pitch at a 30% rate, we view it as an astounding success. So when you look at the two differences between these two sports, I'm curious, as someone with a foot in both worlds, I wonder what you see.
I think when guys, and it's great because guys or players will talk to us and just ask some of that difference and all this type of thing. And I think the biggest thing is exactly what you talked about, the failure rate. I think the one thing that baseball teaches you is it teaches you how to deal with failure, number one. But the other thing that you learn very quickly in baseball that relates to basketball is in baseball, nine guys, 27 outs on the average, you're probably getting, what, 3 to 4 at-bats a game or plate appearances. And then if you get out, now you're waiting for 8 more guys to go up on your team or whatever. So point being is baseball, you find out quickly, you have to find a way to impact the game other than just with the bat. And what I mean by that is, and you can't carry those at-bats over. So being able to compartmentalize and put that failure away, let's say you strike out, but then go out to make a throw, make sure you hit a cutoff, make a diving play in the gap or whatever to stop a run. And so trying to just say, how else can you impact the game of baseball rather than just with your at-bat? Did you move a guy over during that at-bat? Did you steal a base? Did you take an extra base on the ball in the gap? So those are the things. And what I mean, how I relate that to basketball is you don't necessarily always know where your shots are going to come from. And so, you know, can you go get an offensive rebound? Can you get a steal? Can you go get another block? Can you make a switch or help defense or something that people don't necessarily always see, but it really impacts winning. So I think those are the two differences. And the other thing, well, there's a lot of differences, but the other big difference is baseball moves so much slower and just, you know, after every pitch and, you know, now they're implementing the clock and all that. But basketball, it's constant, quick decision. You don't have time. You miss a shot. Hey, we still got to get back and play defense. Where you strike out in baseball, you're sitting there, you're dwelling, what did I do wrong? So it's easier to get past it, I feel, in basketball. But the failure to me and dealing with failure, if you can't deal with it in baseball, there's no way you're going to have any success. And in basketball, it's the same thing. It's like, hey, even though you're 5 for 15 or you're 3 for 12, your next shot may be your biggest one. You might go to the free throw line and have to knock some free throws down. So it's trying to, you know, when you have those take those losses within the game, just being able to get past them and move forward.
Speaking of moving forward, Mike, I wanted to ask you about your work with the Minnesota Timberwolves. 3 straight playoff appearances, conference finals last year. How much fun is this team right now? And, you know, how do you see? It seems like it's a team that's still developing, still progressing together and growing. What's your assessment of what's to come as well as what's behind?
Yeah, I think number one, it's amazing how much winning is connected to fun. And so when you do more winning, it's obviously more fun. But that being said, the group of guys that we have, you know, Anthony Edwards is just, and I think everybody's seen him. He's kind of exploded onto the stage now, and especially we'll see it in the Olympics. But he's a guy that is very, very genuine, number one. So never has a bad day. Lost his mother and his grandma when he was very young, around 14, about 6 months apart. And the one thing that they told him was never stop smiling. So, and he's really continued that. And he is who he is. He's not going to change for anybody. And it's really hard to find guys that are genuine all the time. They don't change the cameras and all this. So he's a joy to be around. But then when you start bringing in guys, Carl Anthony Towns, great guy. Rudy Gobert, a professional. Mike Conley, a professional. When you start bringing, I think Coach Finch summed it up the best. When you have adults in the room that, number one, they understand how to prepare, they know when to have a good time, they know when to be serious, and they know how to, be cohesive as a group. It leads to winning, number one. And to me, I correlate a lot of winning with fun. And it's been a great group. And our coaching staff is along those same lines. Very, very cohesive. Nobody looking over their shoulders. Everybody stays in their lane. And the main goal is the culture of the team and winning basketball games and helping support those players and Coach Finch.
Micah, we really appreciate your time. I have one more for you. And, you know, to the best of your ability, if you want and can share, I was wondering what you said to Dante when you all found out that he had been drafted at number 27 by the Phillies.
Man, I tell you, I didn't have much advice for him because being on this side of it, Which is fantastic. I think you can, I mean, when I was a freshman, my senior year draft in high school, there were 50 rounds and I didn't get picked for any of them. And then same thing. And so my career was, I was told I wasn't good enough way earlier than him and he was much better than I. But the one thing I just said to him was, I said, Dante, obviously all the hard work has paid off. He's thought about this moment, but enjoy the moment. You know, take this night and maybe even the next day of just to be thankful and to enjoy that moment and spend it with your family and your friends. And because, you know, you have worked and the work is just beginning again now in minor league baseball, but you deserve to have a night to just, again, just shoot. It's pretty special. I was talking to my brother and my dad. I said, you know, we all dream about this. We've all talked about it. I've been on the other side of it many times where we make picks and you get to call guys, but to be the father of this kind of thing, I think I was much more nervous than him and an experience that he obviously will never forget. And I never got to experience, and for good reason. The scouts, they know how to pick players. But it was really cool. It was a really special evening.
Well, again, Mike, I appreciate you doing this. Congratulations to you and your whole family, certainly to Dante as well. Please pass it along for us. Good luck with the upcoming season, certainly when the season begins in a couple of months, and hopefully we can chat soon.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed the time here, and thank you for thinking of us.
Thank you so much. There he goes, Mike Inori, the assistant head coach with the Minnesota Timberwolves, but maybe more importantly these days, the father of Dante Inori, a very proud father. And I think you could see there when you asked that last question to Mike, I think you could see it. The thing he talked about at the very beginning, Jules, was the idea of like, there's a little bit of relief that comes with this. And I think I totally get it. Like just seeing his face, I 1000% understand.
I mean, he's a father, right? Yeah. He's a loving father, and obviously he knows better than most what goes into it. And so very nice of him to share the joy and the excitement with us. The Ted Lasso of basketball, as he is.
That's what I've heard.
These days, which is pretty pretty accurate, I'd say, when you talk to him a little bit. Very cerebral and yet compassionate guy.
It was interesting to hear him kind of go deep on the difference between baseball and basketball, because this is a guy, Mike Inori, who was a three-sport athlete when he was in college a number of years ago with his dad at Indiana University. He was the captain of a baseball team, and then he kind of sets foot in the world of basketball. And I think that's why I wanted to ask him, because basketball, Jules, I don't know how big of a fan of basketball you are, but, you know, when you watch it, like, you know how baseball, it's the position players, they're on the field, they're playing defense, and then they leave the field, and then they go sit in the dugout until it's their turn to bat, and then if they don't bat, they go back to the field. You know what I mean? Like, you're never really playing offense and defense, like, really at the same time, right? Like, you're not really doing that. Where in basketball, you do that all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, you basically have that in the back of your mind every second these guys are on the court. So I thought that was really interesting to hear him discuss, like, the differences between these two sports in the sense of baseball, which I do view as a sport, quote unquote, of failure, because it's really about guys failing over and over and over and over again until they actually find something they're really good at and succeed at, which is why it's funny to think of, you know, a guy in baseball hitting at a 30% rate, which is batting 300, and you think, boy, this is awesome. Like, in what other sport would you consider a 30% being successful? Probably none, I would say.
Yeah, it is a fascinating contrast between both sports and all the mental and physical preparation and the differences between them. I thought it was pretty hilarious that Mike has said that he would block all of Dante's shots. You need to learn to struggle right now. That's and who better to teach you that than your dad?
I thought it was funny too when he was talking about Anthony Edwards, because Anthony Edwards is we had during one of the Jays games, actually, we had the USA-Canada basketball scrimmage on in the lead-up to the Olympics, which is going to happen, I guess, in like 10 days, I think, at the opening ceremonies, which is pretty incredible just on its own in a vacuum. But USA basketball, obviously favorite to win the gold medal, and they almost certainly will, barring some kind of, you know, probably barring a meteor running into Paris, they're going to win the gold medal in both the men and women's basketball tournaments. But Anthony Edwards, it was funny, he had said, Jules, that On a team where, like, there are guys like LeBron James and Anthony Davis and Steph Curry and, like, basically, like, the world's biggest basketball stars, he was interviewed by, you know, a variety of the media after that scrimmage, and he was basically like, yeah, I'm the alpha dog. I'm the number one guy. And I thought to myself, that's hilarious. That is one of the funniest things any player could say because of, like, the particular circumstance and the context of him being, like, in a room with, like, I don't know, like, the 20 best basketball players on earth, essentially. But hey, you got to have that confidence. If you're a member of and if you're a professional athlete, you got to have that confidence. And I appreciate Anthony Edwards for saying that.
There's a reason why this guy has been getting so much attention right now, and why he's probably, you know, just at the beginning of a very, very prized career here. It's been pretty awesome to watch, and nice of Micah to share those stories,
yeah,
as well.
For sure.
That there's a lot to like about what's coming for this team, and Anthony Edwards is obviously a big part of that.
Appreciate Micah Norrie joining us here on Jays Talk Plus. We're going to take a quick break. On the other side, Eric Longenhagen, Fangraphs lead prospect analyst, will join us. Get the skinny on the day two prospects taken by the Blue Jays. We'll be back after this on Jays Talk Plus. I'm Shou Ali. That's Julia Kreutz. You're watching on Sportsnet 360 and listening on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Hey, it's Ben Ennis.
And I'm Brent Gunning.
We got you covered on all things Leafs, Raptors, and Blue Jays every weekday morning, 6 to 9.
It's the Fan Morning Show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus on the Sportsnet Radio Network. You're also watching on Sportsnet 360. Thanks for being with us today. Shou Ali, Julia Kreutz. We're in for Blake Murphy all week. Julia, Blake being, I think, wisely load managed, not just with the rest of the Major League Baseball season coming up, but also with his upcoming work on the Raptors. I'm sure he was sad to miss out on a chat with Micah, but hey, I mean, he has a lot of time to catch up.
Blake Murphy is everywhere these days.
It's true. On Blue Jays Central, you can often find him on the weekends, is also at the Rogers Center. So
I love watching him on TV.
I think
he's great at it. Yeah, so catch Blake Murphy on television on weekends.
Please do. Yeah, Blake Murphy going to rejoin Jays Talk Plus next Monday. Joining us on Jays Talk Plus right now to help us break down all things Blue Jays draft, take a look around the draft as a whole, is Eric Longenhagen, Fangraphs lead prospect analyst. Eric, how are you?
I'm doing well. I am close to gassed. It's been, you know, a busy couple of weeks and approach of the draft. Having the futures game and the draft in the same weekend is quite a load on the prospect dorks like me, but we're most of the way through it now, and Fort Worth is really lovely and been a heat respite from home in Phoenix, which is like unbearably hot. I think you guys would like melt if you touched down in Phoenix, and I'm probably going to tomorrow when I do.
I heard the Jays actually wrapped up their season in Arizona, and I had heard, Eric, that from some of our, we weren't there, but from some of our colleagues that were there, I heard that it was around like 115 degrees Fahrenheit, which is absolutely wild. Like, I know I spent some time in Florida. I don't think I have ever been in 115 degree weather, I think, in my entire life.
Yeah, we just had the hottest June ever in the history of the city.
Oh,
last year was the hottest summer in the history of the city. Weeks at a time of 110 and above. And yeah, I took my infrared thermometer outside, and the street was 162 degrees on the surface. And I fried an egg on my front sidewalk last week. It was pretty gross. I don't recommend doing it. But it is possible. Yeah, it's maybe not my long term home.
You have to do the egg frying thing once for the experience, right, Eric? You have to.
Yeah, I mean, the government says if it's over 140 degrees, then it's, you know, bacteria free. So 162 degrees on my street out front, you can do it.
All right. Well, I'm glad it passed. I don't know how good it tastes, but I am glad you at least tried it. Hey, look, we appreciate you doing this for us, and I'm glad you are cooling off in Texas. Not words I thought I would say, but I am glad you're doing this for us. We really appreciate it. Look, before we discuss any particular players specifically, I did want to ask you kind of a larger question. When you look at the MLB draft as opposed to other drafts, like, you don't always draft for need. Like, if you're looking at the MLB draft versus like the NFL draft, for example, you draft a guy in the top 10, that guy is probably playing for you next year in some significant capacity. Not always the case, and I would say for the most part it's not the case in Major League Baseball because of the lead time with these young men. But when I see the Jays continue to going after pitchers, for example, two pitchers in the first two rounds, they continue to do so on day two, I mean, even if you're not drafting for need, like, that still must be in the back of your mind, no?
Yeah, I think it is. I think the need at the big league level and the need throughout the organization can be different things. Pitching depth, not only at the big league level, but throughout your minor league system, is paramount. And so there's always going to be a higher volume of pitchers that go for any team, really. But, you know, the speed at which the guys traverse the minor leagues has
been picking up, especially since with the last collective bargaining agreement, a couple minor league affiliates were eliminated. There was like a reduction in the total number of domestic minor league roster spots. And you are seeing now some, especially the top college guys are moving through the system more quickly. Teams are behaving more aggressively with the way they're promoting some of their top players. Do you think the Blue Jays got one of those guys with Treya Savage, who they took in the first round? Obviously, you see Paul Skeens starting an All-Star game a year after he was drafted. Nolan Chanuel with the Angels is in the big leagues not long after he's drafted. So the pace is moving more quickly. But yeah, there's just because of the minor league system, and how there's so much attrition with these guys over time, especially with the high school players. It is a long developmental process. Player development in baseball is such now that you can really augment what guys are doing pretty quickly. And, you know, you have to apply that development to them. And, you know, there's so much tech involved and guys get tired. So it does take quite a bit of time for some of the younger players to traverse the minors.
You mentioned the Blue Jays first rounder, and Yesavage will have an ask, I've seen, that's over the slot value. And I find the slot value discussion when it comes to how that plays into the strategy of drafting players really fascinating, honestly. Like it, Johnny King is someone I want to ask you about in a second here. But with both of those guys, I've read that, you know, if it comes to them being over slot, then when it comes to the rest of your draft, then you have to kind of aim for guys that are under slot. So, and this is not just an only a Jays thing. I'm really just using those two guys as an example. But when it comes to balancing things out, is that something that happens pretty often, especially when we get into day two and now day three of the MLB draft?
Yeah, so especially on the first 2 days. But every team's got their bonus pool. Each of their picks has a slot, a recommended slot amount. You do not have to adhere to that. So then what happens is, teams and agents are negotiating. There's strategy at play where you can offer a player more than slot. The agent can go back to other teams and say, hey, like, you give us $3.5 million or we're going to college, and the other teams might balk at that, and then the guy slides. And so, yeah, with Yesavage and the Blue Jays specifically, you know, on draft night, Yesavage was expected to go higher than he did. And then once we got down to the Blue Jays pick, I'm sitting, you know, at the draft. I'm texting people in most of the draft rooms, and we're wondering why Yesavage has fallen. And we're also trying to get the Blue Jays pick. Like, normally I'm operating 2, 3, 4 picks ahead of what's, you know, on the broadcast, because I'm shuttling information around to the different draft rooms about like who's about to go. So everybody stays like, as it, my sources anyway, stay as like informed as they can be. And we could not get Toronto's pick. It was taking much, much longer for me and people in other rooms to get Toronto's pick than basically the whole rest of the draft. And so it wouldn't surprise me if there was like a phone call made and there was a discussion had, and before news leaked out of that room and to the rest of the clubs that like this is who they were going to take, that there was a determination that, you know, the number is this. And when we see him sign, it wouldn't surprise me if it is over the basically $4 million even slot amount. But yeah, you do have to. You know, there are teams who want to take a top-heavy approach, like the Mariners. The Mariners' second-round pick, Ryan Sloan, supposedly has a $4 million price tag himself, where he's going to go to college. You can't take Durangelo Sainja, who they took in the first round, and then Ryan Sloan in the second, give him $4 million, and then just go slot the rest of the way. You have to cut with seniors, guys who are going to, you know, take less money than their slot amount to stay under your cap, your pool.
Eric, you mentioned wondering during day one why Yesavage fell as low as he did, and I'm wondering if obviously this is something that we in Toronto were also wondering about, is how is it that he was still available by the time the Blue Jays came in to pick, and we were wondering if you came up with any answers to that question.
Well, it's always possible there's something medically going on that we don't know about that was discovered during like the pre-draft process, and that, you know, if teams had him relatively even with some of the other players in the first round, if that was just enough of a tiebreaker for them to pass. It's also possible that those teams picking in the range that we thought Yesavage would go, which like reasonably was in that like 10 to 17, 18 area, know, like talking to people for mock draft purposes in the week or so leading up to the draft. A lot of folks thought Seattle would be his, you know, last spot just because they tried to draft him coming out of high school. But yeah, like it's possible there's something medical, or it's just possible that some of these guys who were left were preferable. I think like there were a couple surprises as far as players who went in front of him. What Milwaukee did at 17, where they took a really young high school outfielder who most of us had like down in, you know, second, third round area. He's going to be under slot, Braylon Payne. PJ Morlando went 16th to Miami, another high school outfielder. I would have guessed that college hitting or Yesavage, who, you know, really only one of the couple college pitchers who were really like mid first round worthy, you know, that they would have gone in that area. But if the Blue Jays had a number in mind and floated that number to Yesavage's camp, and then Yesavage and his camp floated that to the rest of the team, or rest of the teams rather, then, you know, it's possible that those teams picking in the middle third of the first round were just like, we're not going to pay that for a safer, you know, somewhat generic college arm, and let's, you know, deviate to somebody else. And, you know, that might be good for Trey, who gets more money than he would have got at like slot somewhere else. But yeah, I just thought it was good value where they got him. I think he's going to move really fast. I think he's got a chance to be one of the handful of fastest debutant players from this draft and pitch like in the middle or back of a good team's rotation pretty soon.
We're chatting with Eric Longenhagen, Fangraph's lead prospect analyst here on Jays Talk Plus. Show and Julia here with you until the top of the hour. So, Eric, I want to ask you about the Blue Jays' second-round pick, Cal Steven, taken out of Mississippi State. And, I mean, we have heard a lot about the durability of a lot of these guys, a lot of these pitchers. And it felt like the Blue Jays in the last, certainly not only this year, but in the last couple of years, had somewhat prioritized pitching. And when you see Cal Steven, what do you see? Because we've gotten the scouting report from you and others on Yesavage. What do you think you're getting from Cal Steven?
Yeah, I think this really runs through the Blue Jays' whole draft. But he was a transfer from Purdue to Mississippi State. He started his career in the bullpen. Right away, you know, you're looking at a guy where has there been late development here? Is this guy just scratching the surface because he went from smaller school to bigger school and changed roles? And I think that's, you know, in play here for Steven. Certainly prototypical pitcher frame at 6'4", 215. This guy's built like an NFL quarterback. It's low mid-90s fastball. Doesn't have a monster heater in terms of velocity, but there are other elements that are helping it play. It's ride, it's carry, it's angle of approach to the plate, and two good breaking balls. So, you know, guy who's in the bullpen now has a 3-4 pitch mix, hasn't been a starter for very long, looks the part in the uniform, looks the part on the mound as far as like what his delivery looks like, just basically checks every box. I thought he was a very appropriate second round pick. I had him right in the range where they took him.
And then, Eric, we have the third round pick of the Blue Jays, who's Johnny King. So Blue Jays kind of veering away from the college arms a little bit, but staying committed to adding pitching here, but go with a high school arm in the third round. What can you tell us about Johnny King, the fourth?
Yeah, big 6'4 lefty, one of the younger guys in the draft. He's barely 18. Really deceptive, like rock and fire delivery, athletic for his size. Just a very typical delivery for a big league lefty. Crude feel for release. Quality of his strikes, you know, comes and goes. Low 90s fastball, two-plane breaking ball in like the mid-upper 70s. You'd expect someone who's barely 18 at this size to add velocity as he matures. And so, you know, I had him, like in the $800K, $1 million range. I had him ranked 90th overall. He went 95th. I don't know what his number is going to be. It's possible it's over slot. It's possible it's more than what, you know, the number I have on him. But as far as the high school pitching at that part of the draft, for, you know, the money that the Jays had lying around at that point, I thought he was an interesting addition as well.
And when you look at other guys as well, I mean, especially with guys who've had injuries, I always wonder how they profile to you, an expert in these kinds of things? Because you look at, Eric, a guy like Jackson Wentworth, who was taken in the fifth round, also a phenomenal name. It almost sounds like he could be like a lawyer, like Jackson Wentworth, the character on Better Call Saul. It's a phenomenal name. But fifth round pick out of Kansas State. He's had TJ surgery. It looks like he struggled. And I'm really just reading box scores. So you'll have to tell me more. But it looks like he struggled a little bit after he came back from TJ surgery. Not surprising. It's a tough thing to come back from. But the slider, the change, they look like they generate some good swing and miss. When you look at Wentworth, what do you see?
Oh, yeah. I thought, you know, Jackson Wentworth in the fifth round was pretty good value. Strike-throwing starter. Didn't walk anybody really last year. And you're right. Other than the fastball, the rest of the repertoire, this guy's got five pitches. All of the pitch-by-pitch performance is very strong. So, you know, miss rates on pitches at the big league level, you know, average is like hovering right around 28-30%. And for Wentworth, aside from his fastball, everything is like comfortably north of that in the 38-40% range. Cutter, slider, curveball, changeup. Tommy John, the way you weigh it is tough because there are people who think after you have, if you're going to have two of them, that's a problem. And if you've already had one, then now we're sort of playing Russian roulette with your elbow for the next 5 years or so, which is generally the time period people worry that, you know, after your new ligament lasts 5 years is like perhaps a apocryphal thing, but it is a general industry sentiment.
Right.
And so when Wentworth had one as a freshman in college, and now we're 2 years into his fresh UCL, what does that mean for the next couple of years? So that'll be interesting to see. You know, this guy sits 92. We'll see if he can add velocity. He's, you know, a college player. He's physically mature. He's like 6'1", 220 or so. You know, so there's probably not going to be a whole lot more velocity. Can the Blue Jays do something else to help his fastball play? Can he pitch backwards off his secondary stuff more? Does that type of approach to pitching work better in like a long relief capacity rather than as a starter? And these are things that are going to work themselves out. But as far as a guy throws strikes with like a bunch of big league quality pitches, to get someone like that in the fifth round, I thought their draft was quite good. And this was one where when he came off the board in the fifth round, I was like, okay, like this is a pretty deep class of interesting guys. There are like half a dozen guys here who, you know, are legitimate prospects in my estimation. And that's quite a haul for, you know, the baseball draft.
Yeah, I've always been curious, Eric, when it comes to trying to make the determination of what a pitcher can be. Obviously, it's hard to know until they actually play in major league games, for example. And I know, like, we in Toronto often had the conversation about what Nate Pearson might be, for example, after being a pretty high draft pick and being a pretty high ranked prospect in the Toronto Blue Jays system for a long time. And I think a lot of the expectations have fallen dramatically, unfortunately, for Nate Pearson, because he was, I think, viewed as a starter. And now looking at him, you look at him as a reliever. When you look at prospects, and I know it's really hard to do this, it's almost an impossible task, because when we're talking about Johnny King IV, he's like 17, 18 years old. I mean, how do you know what a 17, 18-year-old player is going to look like when he debuts when he's like 22 or 23, let's say? But in making that determination between what a player can be as a starter or a reliever, like how do you at least, like, are there any telltale signs, maybe a better way of asking it is, when you look at a guy's career in terms of how he profiles in either role?
Yeah, I think there are different schools of thought, and with Pearson specifically, it was just always such a violent operation, and he was always so big. And Nate Pearson's done a lot to like change his physical composition since he was at a junior college in Florida, and you know that to me is not only is it a physical improvement, but it's indicative of a certain like aspect of his personhood and the Blue Jays player development to like get him to do that. But yeah, like throws hard. It's incredibly violent. He's gigantic. And so there are people who think, look, if you throw strikes, I don't care what it looks like.
Right.
Just throw strikes. And then there are others. And I, you know, count myself among this latter group, unless you really prove it to me. Like essentially just, I'll believe it when I am proven wrong from any individual that it's just supposed to look graceful and easy and effortless. Like the best guys are typically built a certain way and their bodies move a certain way. And it's almost always 6'3" ish with just beautiful, effortless grace and fluidity like Sandy Alcantara in Miami. And he blew out too, you know what I mean? So, you know, there are plenty of guys where it looks right and it just doesn't play. Nate Pearson, from a bullpen standpoint, if you would have told me, look, they're going to put Nate Pearson in the bullpen, I would have said, great. Wherever I have him on the top 100 is still right because he's going to be a monster back there. But it just hasn't played out that way. And there are lots of guys for whom that's true. Michael Kopech with the White Sox is another one where it was like, hey, is this guy a starter or is he a reliever? And they tried and tried and tried, and it didn't work. They move him to the bullpen, and it still isn't working. And so, yeah, this is classic. You can't predict baseball. Take these monster dudes with huge stuff, and sometimes it still doesn't quite work out.
Or, so, you know, sometimes on the flip side too, right? I mean, maybe it does work out. Like, Jules, I was thinking of, when as Eric was talking about Kopech, I was thinking of, like, Garrett Crochet, who is a reliever, and who is now maybe one of the best starters in Major League Baseball, or Reynaldo Lopez, who is an all-star, or even used to play for the Blue Jays, Jordan Hicks, who kind of took some velo off his fastball and is now a starter. Like, Eric, I've always found that so fascinating, the role, the dichotomy, the change between being a starter and reliever, or I suppose on the flip side, between being a reliever and a starter.
Yeah, it's, you know, so much of it is about player development and what the org you're in is capable of doing for you and with you, and openness of the players to those changes. But yeah, if you just go to Fangraphs and sort the pitching leaderboard by WAR, there are a bunch of guys at the very top who were once thought of as relievers, or at least had a lot of relief risk. I mean, Chris Sale, he's been doing it for so long ago now that it feels like, you know, the distant past. But when he was at Florida Gulf Coast, you know, there are no starters who throw a baseball like that. And then you look at Tanner Houck, who is a mirror image of him, like from the right side. And when he was at Missouri, it was the same thing. Like, is this guy a starter or not? And I think that their teams are becoming more and more open. Some of it is scientific in nature. Some of it is like data regression. You see these guys with much lower, like lower slot guys were once always thought of as being relievers, and it's becoming much more common to see them at least developed as starters. But even, you know, Tarik Skubal, when he was at the University of Seattle, he had Tommy John there, and when he came back, he was so unbelievably wild that the first year he was draft eligible, nobody took him. You know, like, he was just so bad that nobody even drafted him. And it took a whole nother year before teams got on board. And even then, he didn't go very high. But, you know, it takes, like, the player working, the team developing, having the right people in your organization. And sometimes that involves, like, putting nodes on a naked pitcher's body and watching him, you know, move with cameras that shoot at 2,000 frames per second, see how the ball's coming off his fingertips. And sometimes it's just about, like, what kind of person is this? What kind of people do we have in our org who are going to try to, you know, get the most out of that guy?
Eric, in the spirit of the unpredictability of baseball here, this is the Blue Jays farm system. We kind of look at the top. We obviously know the Ricky Tiedemans, the Arjun Namalas of the world, and we know that they have been hit with a little bit of bad luck, really, on the injury front for these top prospects. But I'm wondering if there's anyone in the Blue Jays prospect pool that may be flying under the radar, and that's a guy that you are particularly excited or curious about in the coming years.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you like what Spencer Horwitz is doing, then maybe follow Alan Rodin, a smaller school draftee out of Creighton. He's never swung and missed at any level. He's, you know, not running a great batting average at AAA in his first, like, couple of weeks there, but it's still so early until he was promoted to AAA. Like, that guy's done nothing but hit his whole life. So Alan Rodin, I mean, he's a stocky little pudgy guy, like, pretty overlooked if you're just scouting guys off of, like, body athleticism, that type of thing. He's definitely one I watch out for. Things with Namala not going well, huh? You know, one of those interesting ones when he was drafted, there were questions, you know, is this guy going to hit? I had more questions about Namala at the end of his senior spring than I did the summer before. He kind of hit on the showcase circuit, and then when I went to see him in Florida during his senior spring, kind of dried up, just looked kind of lost there. And I'm surprised at how severely that has carried into pro ball. But yeah, I think, like, Alan Roden, if you're looking for a sleeper, he's not like at the bottom of the system or anything. I always really like TJ Brock. It might just be a reliever. He's a less than 100K signee out of Ohio State in 2022, went in the sixth round. He's been injured some this year, but it's, you know, one of the better sliders in minor league baseball, let alone the system. Just a guy with plus fastball, plus slider, chance to be a late inning reliever pretty soon. I think that's the other one that folks maybe are sleeping on a little bit.
We're chatting with Eric Longenhagen, Fangraph's lead prospect analyst. And Eric, before we let you go, I admit I derailed this conversation when it came to asking more philosophical questions. But I did want to get your take on two more guys before we let you go who were recently drafted. And fourth rounder, Sean Keyes, sixth rounder, Aaron Parker. Sean Keyes, a third baseman, big dude. I've heard him referred to as barrel-chested, which always makes me really interested in his physical size, but left-handed hitter. And Aaron Parker, the catcher out of UC Santa Barbara. And of course, we talked about not necessarily drafting for need, but catcher is a position that the Blue Jays, the once it felt like we're dealing from a position of strength and less so these days. So it feels pretty prudent that they took a catcher at some point in the first couple of rounds here.
Yeah, I like both those guys. Sean Keyes out of Bucknell, Patriot League school. Anytime the small school hitters, especially the hitters, start to come off, it's really interesting because at a certain point the teams decide, do we like this small school hitter more than the guys in the SEC or the Big 12? And with Keyes, I think that, you know, his stock really moved once he started meeting with teams before the draft. People were telling me as this guy was walking into the room to meet with people, like, they cannot believe how big and strong this guy is. And so, like, you just don't know, right? Like, Patriot League pitching is not anything close to SEC pitching. It's not anything close to, you know, low or high A pitching.
Right.
And so, like, you can't look at what Sean Keyes has done, what his triple slash line is, and like really derive anything from that. But just in terms of his strength and physicality, it is there. It is there. This is like a no doubt big league body and strength. And it's, you know, heuristically, the profile is very strong. A lefty hitting third baseman. Maybe he'll play, you know, some first base, some second base. But I thought it was a worthy gamble where they took him. And then Parker, yeah, look, Aaron Parker led a top 20 pitching staff in baseball. UC Santa Barbara was a very good team. This is that team's starting catcher. He's little, 5'8", 5'9", or so, like 220. Very comfortable low-to-the-ground ball blocker. He does not have a great arm, but he's still at least on tape. I don't know what his numbers were, but just in terms of like what I have access to on tape, threw out more guys than stole on him, even though his arm isn't that good because he's so little and he's just so explosive out of his crouch. That ball, he turns that around so fast. And surprisingly, this is when they picked him. You know, I went back and looked at some of the TrackMan data from college. And in terms of like how much power there is and how consistently he is getting to it, it is right up there with some of the other catchers who went like late first, early second round. Like I just have him next to Caleb Lomavita from Cal, who went, you know, in the comp round in my spreadsheet. And I was just surprised at like the consistency of the power, the exit velocities, the combo of big exit velos and launch. Like all of his percentages in those categories are on par or better than Lomavita, who just has like a more typical athletic big league look to him. He's not, you know, 5'8", 220. So yeah, I thought that was a very interesting pick as well. That's a guy who I would expect is in Double A pretty quickly. Like it wouldn't surprise me if Parker is a Double A catcher within like a year, year and a half.
The MLB draft continues today, wraps up in Texas. Eric Longenhagen is a Fangraphs lead prospect analyst, and he'll be covering it the whole way. And he does great work on Fangraphs.com. Hey, Eric, we appreciate you doing this. Appreciate you giving us a skinny on some of these guys. Hopefully we can chat soon and enjoy the last bit here. Hopefully you can get some rest before heading back to a hot Phoenix.
I appreciate you having me on, guys. Talk to you soon.
There he goes. Eric Longenhagen again from Fangraphs. Yeah, it's always really interesting, Jules, finding out about a lot of the guys, I mean, a lot of these very young men, essentially, right? I mean, they're guys who play all over North America, essentially. They're talking about college, talking about prep school, high school, like baseball academies. Like, you're talking about a whole variety of different conferences and the varying level of competition from the SEC all the way down, right? So I think that's one of my favorite parts of the MLB draft. And like, you're not even really mixing in the international players as well, all of whom have their own really interesting aspects to them as well when it comes to how they're signed and how players are developed from an international standpoint versus in North America. But I mean, I find all of that super fascinating when it comes to how the Blue Jays make their decision-making processes. And we talked about this yesterday when we talked to Jeff Ponce from Baseball America. But, you know, the Jays farm system is not exactly, the best, I would say, all things considered. So to see them try and, I suppose, restock it to a certain point or reinforce it, I suppose, I mean, we're not going to know what Aaron Parker or Sean Keyes or Cal Stevens or Johnny King IV will be for probably a number of years, but it's good to see them starting somewhere, I suppose.
It is. And speaking with Eric, speaking with Mike Inouye a little bit earlier in the program, we kind of realize or are reminded of the fact that there is so much that goes into the moment of the draft. It's a culmination of, first of all, extremely hard work on the side of the players, but there is so much projection, data, analysis that is done ahead of time, and still, nothing is guaranteed, right? So, player development is always going to be one of the most fascinating parts of baseball because it is, again, so different from other sports, and it takes longer and it is more, I guess, deliberate, if you will. So this is definitely an exciting part of the All-Star break every time, because not only does it give you hope, right, or something to look forward to, but also you kind of get to experience a little bit more closely just how much work is done ahead of time to make sure that you have the best possible prospects and projections moving forward in the farm system.
That is Julia Kreutz. I'm Sho Ali. You're listening to Jays Talk Plus here on the Sportsnet Radio Network, also on Sportsnet 360. Let's take a quick break, Jules. When we come back, let's talk a little bit more about the Home Run Derby. Some clips to share for you. Maybe a quick discussion on the anthem we heard last night. Certainly, I think up there in the annals of Star-Spangled Banner deliveries at sporting events over the course of the last several years. So we'll talk a little bit about that. Teoscar Hernandez, the new Home Run Derby champ, and a certain Blue Jays first baseman who we'll see tonight at the Midsummer Classic, also factoring in pretty largely as well. So still lots to come. All things Derby, all things All-Star Game on the other side. You're listening to and watching Jays Talk Plus on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Hey, it's Ailish Forafar.
And I'm Justin Cuthbert.
Join us as we discuss the most important sports stories of the day and tee up the biggest games of the night.
It's The Fan Pregame, 6 p.m. weekdays on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Final segment of Jays Talk Plus here on the Sportsnet Radio Network, also live on Sportsnet 360. Thanks for being with us. Sho Ali, Julia Kreutz here with you until the top of the hour. Home Run Derby last night, Jules. A lot of fun. Teoscar Hernandez being crowned the newest champion. Blue Jays winning two in a row. No, unfortunately, they did not. Los Angeles. Oddly, the Dodgers had never won the Derby before. Like, there's never been a player for the Dodgers, oddly, or the Royals. So if one of Witt or Teoscar winning would have made it the first in their franchise's history.
Right.
So no one had ever won before, which was, honestly, given the relatively, prolific nature of pretty much any player who plays for the Los Angeles Dodgers, I was a little surprised to have learned that Teoscar Hernandez was the literal first player to ever win the Derby for that team.
That is odd and pretty unexpected. But if anyone is going to do it, it's going to be Teoscar Hernandez, right? I think he, obviously, when he played here, he was straight up a fan favorite.
Yep.
And being on the Dodgers, it's a team filled with stars. Maybe this is a guy that is going a little bit more under the radar, but not anymore. He definitely put himself very much in the conversation. And again, a guy that has been making an impact and helping teams win games for a long time now. It's kind of cool to see him get the recognition on that national level as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I said this to you yesterday, but He, in my opinion, he deserved to have been voted in as one of the three starting outfielders for the National League. He was not ultimately, but he is still an All-Star, so it's still deserved. And I think you knew, you knew for a lot of those cases, like Bobby Witt Jr. was not voted in, for example, by the fans because, I mean, he plays shortstop. Gunnar Henderson also plays shortstop. So I totally understand why that didn't happen, but I mean, he still deservedly made the All-Star team. And Teoscar Hernandez did as well. I think it did solidify last night that it is, for me, the best All-Star event out of any of the major sports. They brought up some of the examples with Shai, like the dunk contest, the three-point contest. I actually think the three-point contest, probably for my money, the runner-up at this point. I think if you just take out the games themselves and you're only looking at these special events they do, quote-unquote, I'm going to say the three-point contest is number two, and that basically everything else, fastest skater, the shooting competition, the pass, dribble, shoot thing at the NBA, the All-Star break, certainly the dunk contest as well. I'm going to say they're all competing for third place at this point. I don't know if that's controversial or not.
I don't know. I don't care. I mean, fans are going to have opinions, obviously, but what we saw yesterday was pretty electric. It really was. And you could see the sheer excitement at the ballpark too. You know, when Bobby Witt Jr. in that final round, he kind of started off slowly and you go, okay, well, this is Teoscar's crown to lose now. And then all of a sudden Witt comes back and he's hitting everything and he ties it up at 14 with the clock winding down type of thing. And it was pretty cool to just see the new format in play and what it did for the competition. I got to say, I was on the edge of my seat watching that. Yeah. And it's not just because we both got it kind of right and kind of guessed the final. Oh, yeah. I really wanted to beat you, but it's okay. There's always next year, right?
This is true. When you look at the rules, you brought up the three bonus outs. I think that provided some drama that I hope they keep. I think they will. I think it's proven to be a success. I hope they keep the three bonus outs. The one additional out, 425-foot bomb gives you that. I thought it was genius. I think the drama it provides, I think it was marrying or finding a happy medium between what they did before and what they're doing now. We got to see it in action for Teoscar Hernandez versus Bohm, in the semifinals, because they both ended up, they went to the, what, it was the swing off.
Yeah, right,
the swing off is what they called it. And I thought that was great. And then doubly so for Teo versus Witt, because they both had some really dramatic extra swings, right? I mean, I actually thought when Bobby Witt Jr. got down to the final home run, I thought, there's no way he's gonna catch up here. And I will say, the camera angles they had from the actual feed, I think they do this on purpose, but the angles made it look like every home run was getting jacked for 400 plus feet, essentially, right? It made it look like that Bobby Witt one that just fell short. I thought he hit that to the moon, essentially. Yeah. It's not a criticism. I think it's actually the right thing to do, because you're kind of holding your breath until you see it fall on the turf, essentially, right? So I thought they did a good job. I got to say, I hope it stays the way it stays. And I kind of wondered, to your point from earlier, if by the time we get to next year's Home Run Derby All-Star Week, that maybe there's a little more strategy in play. Like Shai was mentioning, you kind of saw Teo take a couple pitches. And a lot of guys did that when they got to the bonus rounds, because there was no pitch count, I suppose, anymore. Mm-hmm. You're just, let's be real. By the time you get to the last bit, they're probably gassed, right? You're probably so tired.
That's a lot. You can really see how much of a toll that takes on the body, because you can see that the guys get gassed. That timeout in the middle of the round is probably so welcome at that point, because it takes a ton of power and a ton of athleticism to hit one home run in the major leagues, let alone 15 in a row or whatever it is that those guys were doing there. And you mentioned the Bobby Witt one that just missed. That would have made things very interesting. Pretty perfect, pretty fitting that would be decided by inches, right, Joe?
Yeah.
And we really, really got to see the power display, as well as the mental commitment to it, because when you know the number they need to get to and you just kind of calm yourself down enough to trust your ability, to trust your swing and your mechanics and what you're good at to get it done, it was a pretty cool display of not just, home runs are sick, but also the mental side of the game and the physical part of it.
I always think of that quote from The Simpsons when Mark McGwire comes out, like the Major League Baseball satellite, like falls out of the sky, and he's like, "Do you want to know the terrifying truth, or do you want to see me hit a few dingers?" And they're like, "Dingers, dingers." I always think of that whenever I see, like, really at any point, but when specifically for the home run derby, I think
I
with good reason. Let's hear a little bit of the sound from last night. Certainly, see some of the visuals as we have been. And I want to start with the anthem. So Ingrid Andress, a four-time Grammy-nominated artist, was tasked with singing the anthem. Now, in her defense, I think after Jimi Hendrix and Whitney Houston and even maybe Chris Stapleton more recently, they made it, I think, like unfair for a lot of people to do again. I think the Star-Spangled Banner is like it's a losing proposition, I think, to volunteer to sing this song. Having said that, tough look for Ingrid. I felt a little bad for her, but as Tim McAuliffe said on Sportsnet Central last night, it was a bad day to have a bad day.
For the land of the free, and the home of the brave.
That's so good. I gotta say the visuals from the, like, so you kind of saw there the camera panning around the field, right? And of course, the thing that I think it conjures for a lot of people more recently, as you compare All Star Week, so is Fergie at the All Star Game from a couple,
yes,
of years ago. And you know, I find that the comparison is interesting because on one hand, what they did at the NBA All Star Game when Fergie was singing. And she kind of like remixed it live, right? Which is, I think, why she, like, her actual singing wasn't that bad. It was like the choice to do what she did,
it was
effectively,
the choice,
right?
Yes.
I think that's why people were like got a little like defensive about it. But at the same time, the NBA broadcast deliberately chose to show as many of those players as humanly possible, and like LeBron and Draymond Green and all these guys, like, effectively laughing. Like, they're just like laughing out there,
yeah.
And it was funny on the Major League Baseball one. I think they showed very briefly Alec Bohm, like, essentially laughing. I think he was,
yeah,
trying his best not to burst out laughing, and they just did not show any players for the rest of the national anthem, which I thought, you know what, maybe that's a business decision on their behalf, but I kind of wished we had seen
the
expressions and reactions of the other guys.
Yes, and listen, Joe, I understand that Fergie made a choice. There were some choices made in this one.
That's
too.
True, too. This is true.
There was some flourish that was not necessary. And when you say that, you know, it's been made hard because it's done pretty much in every sporting event, and sometimes you're going to get the really iconic ones that kind of take over. If that is the case, then just do the basic, the bread and butter. It's fine. Just sing the anthem and get out of there. There's no need to try to reinvent the wheel. And it didn't work. I'll say this. I had it on mute because I was doing something else at the time. I was working on something else. But just from the visual of it, I thought, this doesn't seem to be going well. And then, one of my text chains with work people, work friends, kind of started blowing up. And I thought, yes, this definitely did not go well.
No, I look, in her defense, I do think that she was nominated. I looked up at the Grammys for Best New Artist back in 2021. And I mean, that's like a pretty good honor for the Grammys, like one of the more prestigious award shows, right? So I'll say this. I wonder if maybe she was kind of just like put in a bad position. Like, you know, maybe the Star-Spangled Banner, a lot of high notes, right? Not the easiest song to sing. You know, she's a country singer. Some lower registers for her, perhaps. I don't know. So maybe that's what it is. But unfortunately, I think when we make the best of national anthems clips that's going to be played on Sportsnet Central going forward, I'm guessing, unfortunately for Ingrid, that's going to be there. This next clip was a Julia Kreutz special request. Would you care to introduce this clip, Julia?
Okay, so here's what happened. I have seen this clip 22 times at this point,
okay, all right,
and it gets me every single time. This is Gunnar Henderson's Scooby-Doo impression. Here we go.
Gunnar, real quick, give me that Scooby-Doo impression.
Scooby-Doo impression?
Yeah, all
right.
I gotta say, first of all, I love Eduardo Perez. I think he's the best. And his genuine reaction, I think, tells you everything you need to know about
Seriously.
That. He just laughed his head off. It's amazing. By the way, terrific Scooby-Doo impression for Gunnar Henderson. So it's spot on, I gotta say.
I think that the reaction from the desk is as good as the impression itself, because those guys were living for that.
Oh my goodness.
And again, you know, part of the festivities, part of the reason why the All-Star Week is so much fun is you get to see these guys' personalities still show. What I keep coming back to is, how did they know?
How did they know?
I know that Gunnar Henderson came in and he had a Scooby-Doo bat and said zoinks in it and whatnot, and that's pretty cool. Still, though, how did the conversation get from that to, oh, I do a pretty good Scooby-Doo impression?
He must have been doing it around them.
Yeah.
Because the desk was right there on the field, right? Like, he must have been, and like Shai was saying, like, it's part of the thing you like about the Derby is them seeing them all hang out with each other.
Yeah.
He must have just been doing it, and they must have overheard it or something, because it's true. How else would you know?
Man, and, you know, to be Gunnar Henderson, right? To have this so experience, good. To be there, and such a brilliant career ahead of him if everything stays the course right now. To have those experiences and then to also have those moments of levity, that was pretty cool. I gotta say, it not only does it crack me up every single time, it also kind of makes me happy that we get those experiences, that we get to see those guys like that.
Those are that's kind of the big part of the All-Star Week, the festivities, the Derby, everything in between that you kind of like, right? So I'm totally with you. Let's hear one last clip. This was Teoscar Hernandez post-Derby. So he's sitting at the podium. I think you'll hear Shai Davidi's question in here as well. But one of the aspects of last night that I personally really liked is when Vladdy came out to give Teo some advice. And you knew as the former champ he was going to be out there, certainly, but with his good friend even more so in Teoscar Hernandez. But he was wearing a Teoscar Hernandez Blue Jays jersey. And Shai Davidi asked Teo the question after he became the latest Home Run Derby champ. Here's Teoscar Hernandez.
And it looked like you had a couple of nice conversations with Vladdy in the middle, and he was giving you, and I think he pulled out of a vintage jersey of yours as well. Just what were some of your conversations with Vladdy?
That was one of the biggest surprises tonight. What he did, he said yesterday when we get here to the hotel, he said, I got a surprise for you, compadre, so I'm going to show it tomorrow. So he brings my jersey from Toronto, and when he goes to home plate, he was trying to calm down myself. He had passed through that two times, and it works. What he said, it works. It helped me going into the last round in the final.
So maybe the Blue Jays should just make Vladdy the hitting coach at this point. It clearly seems to work, right? He clearly knows what he's doing. I got to say, like, Vladdy was essentially like the Home Run Derby sage. Right, I said this a couple times. He was like the oracle of the Home Run Derby last night, and every time Teoscar Hernandez went on some kind of hitting spree, you'd hear Eduardo Perez and the rest of the guys being like, "Wow, Vladdy, really, whatever he said must have worked, right?" So I gotta say, like, that was one of my favorite aspects of last night. Like, not just because it's a Blue Jay and a former Blue Jay kind of taking center stage here, but because, I don't know, it just, like, their friendship seems very pure, right? Like, it's a very watchable aspect of last night's Derby amidst a lot of watchable aspects.
It really shows how much these two guys know each other. Not only, you know their swings or each other's swings, but also know each other's mentalities when it comes to giving advice,
right,
and knowing what the other person needs to hear. That's not easy to do, and it really does speak to the bond and the relationship that they built while they were both playing for the Blue Jays. I was lucky enough a couple years ago to actually put together a feature on their friendship, and one quote that kind of stands out to me, especially when we look now at what happened yesterday, is the quote is, "It's like we were born to have this friendship."
Oh man.
And so, you know, it's definitely a spiritual thing, more so than simply a baseball relationship. And it worked. It really did. It inspired Teoscar to keep going and to find his swing. So obviously, Vlad has seen enough of Teo to know his swing very well and to know what it is that he needs to look for to get the most of it. But then there's also, you know, the mental aspect of it, the spiritual aspect of it, the fact that Vladdy surprised him with the Teo Blue Jays jersey. I mean, it was all so perfect. Kind of happened, you know, both guys from the Dominican, and now you have back-to-back Dominican champions. Everything happened as it was supposed to kind of like put another chapter together in this storied friendship of theirs.
I mean, and you saw the shot, like, right after Teoscar Hernandez wins. You see the shot of Vladdy. He basically like beelines for Vladdy. And usually there's a bit of pomp and circumstance when the player who wins gets the trophy. He just kind of snatched that trophy. And then Vladdy put the like the chain that said, that kind of like the diamond-shaped chain that said Derby Champ all over his neck. It just seemed like, I don't know. It was kind of cool. And I know Dodgers fans, I'm sure, enjoyed it. But I'm sure Blue Jays fans enjoyed watching that as well.
All we were missing there, show, was the home run jacket.
Yes, it's true. He should have put the jacket on him. You're right. This is what I want for next year now, Jules. I want to see Vladdy come back to participate in the Derby next year to take the chain back from Teoscar Hernandez.
Let's just
that's
do
what
that.
I want.
Let's just intersperse now. It's Vladdy Teo.
That's all you really need, right? Like, I mean, you're probably never going to get like the world's best home run hitters all participating at the same time, right? Like, you're probably never going to get Vladdy with Mike Trout, with Aaron Judge and Shohei Ohtani, like Bryce Harper. You're probably never going to get that, but you can get something pretty close to it. And I would like to the storylines there as well.
It would take a little bit more than $1 million, I think, to get all of those guys to do it. Although,
a lot of money, though.
I mean, yes, listen, I'm definitely not saying that it isn't, but that would be pretty cool. However, I do think it's also nice that we get to see smaller market guys and guys that may be flying under the radar and that have a little bit of a chance here.
The All-Star Game continues the festivities to later tonight. 7:30 Eastern is when coverage starts on Sportsnet. 8 Eastern is when it begins. Thanks to all our guests, Shai Davidi, Mike Inouye, Eric Longenhagen. Thanks to Jen Rolnick, Amit Mann, Austin Mackey. For Julia Kreutz, I'm Sho. We're back tomorrow with more Jays Talk Plus. We will talk to you later.